Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, where are you from? Where am I from? What is our origin? And if you think like I do, I believe that there is a human civilization on many planets around this universe. Human type, not all the same, but I think we're a pretty good type. So where does that come from? And I don't believe we evolved here naturally, just solely on Earth. And there are all kinds of explanations that people have, not necessarily well-grounded, but let's look at a very well-grounded explanation. Because there is a scientist who actually has looked historically at our origins through the writings of ancient civilizations and the stories that they tell and why they tell them and what can back them up. And that man was Zechariah Sitchin, and he wrote many books. And this is a book that I've just read about him, Zechariah Sitchin and the Extraterrestrial Origins of Humanity, and it's written by our guest today, MJ Evans. MJ, welcome.
Good morning, Peter. Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we could talk. This book is really powerful and very unique, along with the other books of Zechariah Sitchin, because it's archaeology. This is using the tablets of the writings from thousands of years ago that explain what he came to understand. And you knew him well, right?
Yes, I did, for almost 20 years. I wouldn't call, and not to take issue with you, but I wouldn't call his work archaeology. He did understand it. He did use information that came through archaeologists and their publications. But he always called himself a reporter. He learned to read the Sumerian tablets and saw in those writings, he also read the translations that were done back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, well before the space age. But when he reread them over 30 years prior to the publication of his first book in 1976, he was troubled by things that the early redactors could not understand. And when he really pressed into those issues, what was it that they called myth, things that the writings they didn't understand, he had an epiphany. He probably even spoke the word eureka because he saw space age concepts, space age activities. His brother worked at NASA and he checked with his brother his understanding and the hunch that he had. And his brother said, yes, it's quite possible. Anyway, even though all this happened just before 1976 when he was writing his first book, he went forward. He was a bold and confident man. He knew his sources well, and he recognized the repetitious content of those sources. Sumerian cuneiform, it's called Sumerian because they were the people who took the original ancient civilization people who came to this earth. They were created, and then they took down what was told to them. Sort of like if you have a secretary, you give her information that you've collected. That's who the Sumerians were. They were the secretaries.
And they were writing about space age technology. And only when you understand this technology can you look at what they're writing, and it matches.
Yes,
it's an understanding of what we know now that the earlier reporters and archaeologists were surmising only as myth because they didn't understand, 100 years ago and more than that, they had no idea about space age technology.
Absolutely. And it's only because of Zachariah Sitchin's space age lens. I always refer to it as he looked at those materials through a lens of space age knowledge, and what he saw was just absolutely astounding. It documents that there was an earlier civilization that first came to Earth 445,000 years prior and lived here for a long time before they encountered a problem with carrying out their mission. And their mission, that very small first group, was to find gold on this planet and pulverize it and send it back to their own home planet, which is called Nibiru, because their atmosphere was dissipating and they needed that metal gold in order to preserve it. So he began to piece together. He was a genius. He was a well-established journalist, and he knew how to write. He knew how to be efficient, but he's also a genius. He couldn't have written the 14 books that he did without having an innate ability to get at the heart of the issue, to clearly put it forward. And, well, it impressed me.
Yes, and it impresses me, too, because not only is he looking at these Sumerian tablets, but he's looking at other, you know, like the Egyptian culture also, and looking at, you know, the facts on the ground as to what the sculpture, the monuments,
the evidence for us.
You know, science hasn't understood why ancient buildings, monuments, were and signs on the ground too of landing strips and all kinds of things that were from those ages that remain, and nobody can explain them, and they don't try to. They just kind of go cross-eyed on us and say, whatever.
A lot of impressive people, meaning people who have a history of writing and publishing, and certainly the government officials that were confounded by it and decided that it might have a threat, so they put it all, you know, essentially in the can and on the shelf, and the military was told not to talk about it. And that attitude toward UFOs and possible contacts from other parts of the outer galaxy, that attitude still holds. Zachariah was not in the forefront like some other folks trying to get the government to release what they know. But what's happening is that public media is doing it for the government. And probably within the very near future, the government will capitulate, as the government of France has already done and Britain is doing, and that is to reveal and to legitimate the sightings and observations that are being made and reported to an organization called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network.
It's amazing, the denial. I once had a conversation with the man who was the head of the International Space Station.
Yes.
And I said, well, what is the most common question asked of you? And he said, I don't know, tell me. And I said, UFOs, what do you know about them? And he said, they absolutely don't exist. There's no such thing. It's all explainable. And that gave him away. You know, there was, you know, it wasn't about curiosity or possibility, and, you know, it was straight denial.
No, but most of the astronauts and the officials of the official national organizations like NASA have been told that they are absolutely not to acknowledge the presence or even discuss the possibility. And if they breach that guidance, their livelihood will be taken away, their retirement funds will be null and void. There's a whole variety of tactics that have been used on people who do know the truth. And the few astronauts that alluded to it or talked about having seen vehicles outside of
your line breaks up occasionally a little bit because you're out in the north woods of North Carolina,
right.
Northwest Carolina, so it's not a clear signal.
Do I need to speak louder?
No, it's just that here and there the line breaks up and we lose a word or two or three.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
But what you're saying is understandable.
Okay.
Anyway, and so this is, you know, we can understand that there's a lot of denial around, and especially when somebody like Sitchin goes into great detail of what is depicted on these tablets, these ancient tablets, and it's very hard to corroborate it only because you have to be able to translate these tablets, and a lot of them have been broken up, and you have to travel to different places to read them.
He spent eight years at the British Museum with the archaeologists who were piecing back together those shattered tablets. And he described it to me one day. He said, it's a great big long desk with a bunch of drawers right under the surface. And he said, different stories are stored in different drawers. And he said, there'll be a person there reading a piece of the ancient cuneiform who will hold it up and say, does anybody have, and then give a little précis of what the subject is that on the little piece they're looking at. And he said he spent 8 years there with permission of the authorities that run that museum doing similar things. So he keeps himself in the original sources. He also read everything that had ever been published by the early redactors, translators of those ancient materials. Cuneiform. What's called Sumerian is really Nephilim.
What's called what? I miss that word.
Cuneiform, which is the name of the language. It's done with straight lines and crosses, and doesn't look like English, doesn't look like any alphabetic sources of language that we have. What those early scholars did is really remarkable. They learned how to translate that, and the stories, the message was put in columns. So it went from the top to the bottom of the first column, from the bottom to the top of the second column.
Uh-huh. Tricky.
Yes, and eventually it was in some cases, some rather unusual quirks of events, that one or two of those ancient scholars, very brilliant men in their own right, figured out that the language was syllabic, meaning E dot N K I, as the name of one of the key actors. So it was the syllables that were eventually translated into what we call recognizable language.
Uh-huh. So now let's talk about the details. You know, one thing is the context, the other is the content. And it's so fascinating because these are really elaborate stories that are told on these tablets.
Absolutely. Unbelievable, you know, that is what they were called by the early scholars. Had to be the imaginations of the whoever wrote them. Could not
Right, it couldn't have been fact. It had to be imagination.
Right.
Because they couldn't understand how all of this elaborate detail could make sense on the physical plane. Because they're talking about extraterrestrials, and, you know, these are beings that were about 8 feet tall? 8 to 12 feet tall. And they were seen as gods by the people who were actually created by them. And the story is that's written in the tablets is that they took hominids, which were, I guess, like early cavemen, and they mated them with these Anunnaki travelers from this other planet. And
wait a minute. Let me offer a correction. They took the DNA from one of their own Anunnaki astronauts, and they took the DNA of the hominids that were walking around, and they had a couple that were relatively unafraid of them, and they used genetic engineering to blend the qualities of the strands of DNA from both of those sources. And they tried and worked on this. The chief scientist was the first one to land on Earth with his small group of workers, and his name was Enki. He and his sister was a chief called the chief nurse, and she was probably the most proficient scientist, although Enki was known for his many, many scientific bodies of knowledge. Anyway, together they worked in a laboratory, and they tried many, many, many combinations. And finally, in fact, there is a what's called a pictogram. They would take pieces of very hard stone, like ivory, and they would carve on it a picture. And then they would take wet clay, lay it out on a table, and roll this cylinder seal, is what they were called, roll it out on the wet clay, and they get a picture. And one of the most famous pictures is of two beings, one of them on the left, a male, one on the right, a female. Behind the man is a set of test tubes, and she is holding up a being. And the text that went with this pictogram said, in the female voice, "Look what my hands have wrought." In other words, when she got a recognizable, perfect being that was like themselves in every way that they could genetically make it like them, that was the first human. They called it the ADAMU, the Adamu.
Uh-huh. Now you know that was the Adam, the original.
Adam.
Right. And so they started to create humans from this blend of DNA.
Yes.
And so we have a lot, and the book goes, your book goes into a lot of Sitchin's writings about the way that these Anunnaki behaved, and we have a lot of their behavior in our genes.
Well, I believe that, and I was bold enough to say that in two or three places throughout the book where it seemed appropriate, because in some cases, the behaviors, for example, the proclivity of the leadership of these ancient astronauts, was for using sex and lovemaking.
Your line is breaking up. It was for, and then I lost the rest of that sentence.
Okay, their proclivity was to weave sex and lovemaking into their activity. So much of their political activity had that dimension. And I found myself finding the words love and lovemaking in the indexes of Sitchin's books, and realized this was a major issue that he was seeing in the text and that he needed to bring forward and explain. And here's this very serious-looking, bespectacled man writing about sex, love, lovemaking, intercourse, all kinds of things that we would probably not want to put in print and put our name against it.
But the truth is that we are a society that's heavily run by sex and love and war. And these were these beings who were here from Nibiru, they also were warlike, and they did a lot of created a lot of disasters on this planet from their behavior.
Taught the created humans how to carry out war. They had an iron factory on the Nile River where the Aswan Dam is now located. And after they'd had one war that was essentially the internecine warfare between the two major clans of the Anunnaki, who were now on Earth and doing all sorts of things, but they taught humans for the first time to use the weapons that they were making. And these are known as the Pyramid Wars. There's what the first Pyramid right. War was more involved with the Anunnaki.
But the humans were also infused with the DNA
yes.
from extraterrestrials to be yes. warlike.
But
so
they're
it
also
came natural.
It is natural to an extent. Humans were taught by these people who created them, who they looked up to, probably because of their very advanced knowledge, what was probably called by some Anunnaki magic. People, humans, could not understand how they did what they did, and they did it because their civilization was way, way ahead of where we are now. Sitchin puts a phrase on one of his books, Genesis Revisited, and it says, "Is modern science catching up with ancient knowledge?"
Your line just broke up again, and Sitchin said that it's...
Is modern science catching up with ancient knowledge? That's on the front cover of his book called Genesis Revisited, because he was realizing that more and more our space science was creating things that these ancient people, hundreds of thousands of years before humans populated the Earth, these ancient people who built cities, who had these enormous buildings called ziggurats, who gave to the Sumerians all of the indications and practices of civilized living. And it's that kind of understanding that creates the uniqueness of Sitchin's work.
Right. And so the idea here is that he's holding this ancient work in a modern context that hadn't been held before.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and then we can start looking at this in a larger context of evolution too. And to me, it's like we were bred to have frailties. We were bred to not be as bright as we could be. But
they did make sure. In fact, this was one of the goals of these of Enki and his sister and Herzog. One of their goals was to create an intelligent worker who could think for themselves, who could carry out responsibilities with just being instructed, and who could accomplish these things. And there's a scientist by the name of Samuel Noah Cromer who outlines in two or three of his books, and he wrote before Sitchin, who lists the dimensions of civilization that the Sumerians had. Well, the Sumerians got it because it was dictated to them, and they learned how to scribe in wet clay. So the Sumerians created the tablets that we now use as the sources. But the information was given to them like you would dictate to your secretary.
Uh-huh.
That's another thing that gets totally confused, because just about all of the early scholars keep talking about the Sumerians doing all this. The Sumerians were created humans.
And right, and to be just workers for the extraterrestrials.
Yes, but there's another thing that really bugs the daylights out of me, and it's that some of the authors refer to those created humans as slaves. I have a paragraph in the book where I say if they were slaves, then they would have not have had free motion. They would have not have been able to create their own agendas. They would not have been given the responsibilities they were given over many thousands of years. And see, the other thing that's hard to understand is the Anunnaki live by a different calendar. 1 year for them is approximately 3,600 of our years, because we work on a solar dimension. So when the sun gets, you know, through four different seasonal positions on the Earth, we call that a year. They had 3,600 years in outer space and only a few of those years coming into our solar system and zipping around our sun.
Right. So they had a different idea of time. And they lived a lot longer than we lived because that was
because that
was bred into them.
Well, it was the way they thought about living their life. They probably, if truth would be known, if we had more information, have signposts that we call the constellations of the galaxy. And those
right.
signposts are markers on their travel out through deep outer space.
Well, there's so much to talk about. And
yes.
This is only a half an hour show. Hopefully we can do another show in a couple of weeks and talk more about the details of what was in the writing. What does it mean for us
right.
as a civilization? Who are we in terms of how we were created and what we've done with it or not, mostly not, in terms of advancement? I think there's so much that we can look at, and your book is full of many, many of the stories of the past that were written into the tablets about their flying machines, you know, about their relationships, and just a lot about, you know, who we are in relationship to them and what they brought with them and the stories of their civilization while they were here and what they did to us. And,
yes.
you know, it involves Adam and Eve. It involves the Great Flood. It, you know, there's so many. There was actually nuclear war during that time. And so there's so much that we can look at. Is that all right to have a future show?
That would be nice. It has to be in August because I'm going to be going to the West Coast and giving some presentations at various venues out there. So
all right,
I
or maybe you can...
on the road until the end of August, until August, the second
All right,
week.
So that's what we'll do.
Okay.
So, MJ, thank you so much for being on Energy Stew. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. And this is
I've
really
enjoyed talking with you and
work.
Hearing your contributions. So,
well,
yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good trip, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye. And this is Peter Roth, host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you. This is exciting subject matter. You might have something to say. You could email me or call me. And the book is Zechariah Sitchin and the Extraterrestrial Origins of Humanity by M.J. Evans. And I'll look forward to hearing from you. Okay, bye.